Yeah, son, you gotta work late.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
Cause you didn't work late.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
Son, but you're too young to vote.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. Summertime blues.
The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking levels, adjusting camera, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
And the Progressive Voices Network. Oh boy, welcome to the summertime blues. We've got them, don't we? It was a heartbreaker last night. I don't know why we thought that John Ossoff was going to pull it off. Maybe because the polls told us it was so close. It was so close we could taste it. But in all reality, it wasn't that close. Karen Handel pulled out a win of a little more than 4 points over John Ossoff. By contrast, the race that nobody talked about, the one in South Carolina, Ralph Norman beat Archie Parnell by just over 3 points. That one, 2,800 votes is all that separated the two of them in South Carolina. And the Democrats didn't, you know, they completely just totally ignored that race. Now, in all fairness, you know, on Thursdays, usually Howie Klein is here. And Howie is my barometer for all things, all political races. And he even said the Democrats have no shot in South Carolina. It just shows how off we are. It just shows how the polling is unreliable. And this is just an odd time. Nobody really knows. Here's my thought. John Ossoff, well, a couple of thoughts on John Ossoff. Well, and there's that. Look, I'm looking in the chat room, and Robert Hill, New York City, said she pulled out a win if you believe the machines, comrades. You know, and if you read Greg Palast or you listen to Greg Palast, you know that he's done some reporting on shenanigans in Georgia, where the voter rolls were scrubbed, where, you know, look, the Republicans play dirty pool. But just let's pretend for a moment all things are fair. No one ever said life was fair, did they? Let's pretend that all things were fair. And what could have happened here? Well, a couple of things. John Ossoff, as much as I believe it doesn't matter that he lived a couple of miles outside of the district, that's the point that they kept hammering on. Can I just say, for those of you who've been with me for a while, or maybe you don't, you might remember, I feel like I need a shower when I say his name, Alan West. Remember Alan West? He was the congressman for my district. You notice I didn't say he was my congressman. He represented Florida's 22nd district when this was in the 22nd district. He didn't live in this district at all. It's far more common than you would believe, especially if you listen to the ads that played. But that aside, the Republicans used it to good effect. John Ossoff didn't live in the district. He also, in this case, you know, it's weird, depending the day of the week, I suppose, being outside of politics works in your favor. In this case, Karen Handel, this is the third time she'd run for statewide office, and I guess for her, third time was a charm. And John Ossoff was the young guy with no electoral experience. I think he might have been a little too nice. You know, he tried, first of all, he was a moderate. And for those who were, you know, criticizing Bernie Sanders for questioning whether or not John Ossoff was progressive, you know what? They should have let him keep doing that, because in Georgia, it might have worked to his favor not to be the progressive. The way the Republicans painted him was as, you know, Nancy Pelosi's stooge. Also, they painted him as the shooter. Remember, let me see if I can pull this up. I didn't play it yesterday. There was an ad that ran. I don't know if I still have it here or not. Let me look. Yeah, this is an ad. I'm just going to play the audio. It's really offensive. So I'm giving you fair warning here, even above and beyond our usual disclaimer at the top of the show. It is truly offensive because, well, you'll hear. This is an ad that a third party group ran in Georgia, in the Atlanta suburbs there, in favor of Karen Handel over John Ossoff.
Now the unhinged left is endorsing and applauding shooting Republicans. When will it stop? It won't if John Ossoff wins on Tuesday, because the same unhinged leftists cheering last week's shooting are all backing John Ossoff. And if he wins, they win. Stop them. Stop them now. Stop John Ossoff.
Amazing.
Stop Nancy Pelosi. Vote Karen Handel for Congress. Vote Principled Leadership Project PAC. Paid for this ad and is solely responsible
for its content. Principled Leadership Process PAC. Or something. Anyway, that's the kind of dirty pool they played, right? They were down and dirty. They at every turn linked John Ossoff with Nancy Pelosi, the Hollywood liberals, and I'll tell you something else. $30 million from around the country, and mostly small donations, but $30 million no less, poured into that district for John Ossoff. It was a $50 million race. There was a lot of, look, they don't give you the numbers. There was a lot of dark money that poured in to support Karen Handel, too. $50 million. Too much money. And I really think maybe there was overkill. Maybe there was too much. Maybe he was oversaturated. I don't know. I don't know what happened. But I do know a few things. I do know that, again, this is Georgia. It's the Deep South. And Democrats, you know, in recent years, decades, have not fared all too well in the Deep South. And the fact is that this was a safe Republican seat. Since 1979, the Republicans have held on to this seat. And Tom Price, in November, remember when Donald Trump was elected? Even though Donald Trump only got, I think he beat Hillary Clinton by like 1.5 points in that district, Tom Price won that district by 23 points. The fact that Karen Handel only won by 4 is a feat. Now, I'm not making lemonade out of lemons. This sucks. Pure and simple, it sucks. And it shows me that the Democrats still have a lot of work to do. They have not articulated a strong enough vision for how they're going to turn the country around. The other part of it is, you know, maybe Nancy Pelosi is the problem. I'm not an ageist by any means. Look, I would love to see Bernie Sanders run in 2020. I don't think he will, because he'll be 79 at that point. But maybe he will. It's not the number. I'm 57. Do I feel 57? I know a lot of 57-year-olds who are old people. I'm not. You know, it's all in how you comport yourself. But Nancy Pelosi is kind of old school. And here's the rub, as they say. The problem is all the people waiting in the wings for Nancy Pelosi to retire are the people that we also don't want running the Democratic Party, the House caucus. You don't want Steny Hoyer, who is every bit as old as she is and comports himself even older. You got Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who hopefully will be voted out by the people here in South Florida, one district over. Right, Nancy Pelosi is the problem, and it ain't her age. It's not about age. It's about we need new blood. And by new blood, I mean fresh, progressive blood. We need, and maybe blood's the wrong word to use here. We need people like Ted Lieu to come up through leadership. He's still too new in the caucus. But that is the problem. The Democrats don't have a deep enough bench. And that's it. That's the last night's races, the one in South Carolina, where, what's his name? Archie Parnell came really close to Ralph Norman. And maybe if the Democrats had employed the 50-state strategy, you know, paid as much attention in South Carolina as they did in Georgia, maybe the Democrats could have taken that seat. Either way, the fact is that they came so close. You know what? I wonder, I don't know how much Mick Mulvaney won that seat by, the one in South Carolina's 5th District in November. But I do know only 2,800 votes, just over 3 points, separated the Republican and the Democrat in South Carolina. So there's a lot at play here. There's a lot of stuff that is not normal, as in, you know, business as usual. Everything is different. And I would say a lot of, you know, previously safe Republican seats will be in play in 2018. That there is a possibility that Democrats could take back the House, but it's not going to be a slam dunk. And if the Democrats just rely on saying, you know, pointing out the absurdity of Trump's presidency, that won't do the trick. They need to do more. One of the things they're doing this week, at least, is, fighting against the Republican Senate health care bill, Trump care, as it were. Now, there's not a whole lot they can do in terms of practical solutions because the Republicans control the House, they control the Senate, and they hold the White House. So if they get enough of their members to close their eyes and do their bidding, Mitch McConnell and company can get this done. I'll tell you this. Yeah, I know this is, you know, the third day this week that, and it's only the second show this week that I've railed against this. But yesterday I almost felt like I was pounding my head against the wall because we are being gaslighted, folks. Gaslighted. When I interviewed Roger Stone, he didn't know what the term gaslighting meant. Right. That's because he engages in it every day. He knew full well what it means. I read somewhere, there was some article that I read this morning about gaslighting in personal relationships. And as an example, they used a couple where the man and woman were, you know, in the throes of passion, and the man cried out another woman's name. And when the woman called him on it, he said, "I didn't say that. I absolutely did not say that. You're hearing things." That's gaslighting. It's when someone tells you an untruth to the point where they make you feel like you're going crazy. Well, again, John McCain, I played this clip for you yesterday. This is one of the examples. John McCain.
He used to complain like hell when the Democrats ran the Affordable Care Act. Now they're doing the same thing.
Now they're doing the same thing, he said. We used to complain like hell when the Democrats ran the Affordable Care Act. Now we're doing the same thing. No, we're not. They're not, because that's not what the Democrats did. Another example was Rand Paul, who, here's a quote, "We were very polarized because the Democrats did, frankly, exactly the same thing. So we had a very polarized bill that the public debated for years and years. I don't think the parties are any different. I would give criticism equally to the parties." Wrong. He got one part of that right. We debated for years and years. Well, he's talking about after the bill became a law. I'm going to share with you. I was validated this morning by Jonathan Cohn at Huffington Post, who has a piece called "The Big Lie Republicans Are Using to Defend Their Secret Healthcare Bill." And this is it. You got to push back because they're using this line of bullshit and they're trying to gaslight us, and you have to not stand for it. What the Democrats did, the way they got Obamacare through, was wholly different than what the Republicans are doing now. Let me share with you Jonathan Cohn's article. He writes, "Republican leaders in Washington have come under withering assault for the way they're putting together their bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act, specifically for writing the legislation almost entirely behind closed doors with zero Democratic input and with plans to hold a vote mere days and maybe mere hours after finalizing the language. Some Republican senators say they, too, are frustrated by the process, but so far, none has seen fit to demand slower, more open deliberations. They say they're inclined to cut their leadership some slack because, supposedly, Democrats acted the same way when they first wrote the Affordable Care Act in 2009 and 2010. Actually, do I? Oh, man, maybe I didn't pull this one. Mike Lee, you know what? I bet I have it here. Hold on, because Mike Lee did a video. I'll share the audio with you, at least some of it. Hold on. Mike Lee did this video, and in it, he looked right in the camera and said, well, here's what he said.
I haven't seen it yet either, even though I've been a member of this working group among Senate Republicans assigned to help narrow some of the focus of this. I haven't seen the bill, and it has become increasingly apparent in the last few days that even though we thought we were going to be in charge of writing a bill within this working group, it's not being written by us.
Nope.
It's apparently being written by a small handful of staffers for members of the Republican leadership in the Senate. So if you're frustrated by the lack of transparency in this process, I share your frustration. I share it wholeheartedly. The American people need and deserve to be able to see legislation as it moves through the Senate. I hope that we will receive the draft legislation soon. I'm told that it exists. I just haven't been able to see it yet. And as far as I know, the overwhelming majority of my colleagues haven't been able to see it either. Which brings us to the next question. Why exactly should we be moving forward with a plan toward voting on something that the American people haven't seen and that most of their senators in the United States Senate haven't had the chance to see? There's no question that the American people need relief from Obamacare. There's no question that health care has become unaffordable in recent years. And the big question is what we're going to do about it and why it is that we have to act so quickly that we necessarily have to be voting on it next week. I'd be fine, don't get me wrong, to be voting on something soon. But we should be able to see it first. We should have been able to see it weeks ago if we were going to be voting on it next week. So for those of you who have been expressing these concerns, I certainly share them. I will continue to share anything as I'm able to receive it and share it. And thank you very much for your attention to this issue.
So Mike Lee put that out on Facebook Live, again, complaining that he is in the working group that's supposed to be writing the Trump Care bill in the Senate, but he hasn't even seen it, which leads me to believe it's not staffers, that it's the insurance company and lobbyists writing it, because that's how they do things in D.C. now. But regardless, he's one of the 13, and he hasn't seen it. So, all right. So, okay. So back to Jonathan Cohn. I'm sorry. I understand we're not on Progressive Voices, and I think I know what happened. Last Wednesday was the day that we had the lightning strike, and I was off the air. And I think the input wasn't put back in place. I did text the people at Progressive Voices, so hopefully they'll be able to switch it back for us. Hopefully they'll see this. If not, I have a best of show, excuse me, for the 4th of July. Anyway, sorry about that. Yeah, hopefully the Progressive Voices people will know to come over to NicoleSandler.com. Anyway, back to Jonathan Cohn's piece at Huffington Post, you know, about them complaining that the Democrats did the same thing when they wrote the Affordable Care Act. Jonathan Cohn writes, "This is nonsense. As historians and the reporters who covered the 2009 and 2010 debate keep pointing out." Hello. Yes, Democrats cut plenty of backroom deals and pulled plenty of legislative tricks to get their bill through Congress. That's how complicated legislation always comes together. And yes, Democrats ultimately passed the Affordable Care Act on a party line vote. But what Republicans are doing now is fundamentally different and truly unprecedented for legislation of this consequence. Now, here's the fact. Here's the truth. Democrats spent more than a year debating their proposal out in the open. Five separate committees, three in the House and two in the Senate, held literally hundreds of hours of hearings and produced testimony from experts representing multiple philosophical views and officials from pretty much every group or industry involved with health care. Republicans had opportunities to question those witnesses and to propose amendments, some of which actually ended up in the legislation. Lately, Republicans are making a big deal about how Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer vowed not to cooperate with Republicans unless they drop their insistence on repealing the Affordable Care Act rather than finding bipartisan reforms that would fix its problems. But back in 2009, when Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had the same job Schumer does now, he made his own vow of non-cooperation, later telling The Atlantic's Joshua Green he wanted no GOP fingerprints on Democratic legislation. And remember what he said. Their whole thing was about making sure that Obama was only a one-term president, right? So even so, Jonathan Cohn continues, Democratic leaders tried desperately to win over a handful of moderate Republicans who seem most likely to support health care reform. Then Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus, a Democrat in name only, and former President Barack Obama personally invested hours in one-on-one meetings with individual Republican senators. As we discussed yesterday with Laffey, especially then-Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine, who ultimately voted for the Finance Committee's bill, although she voted against the final legislation on the floor. See, we talked about this yesterday. They got all these amendments through and they voted for them in committee, letting you think that they were going to vote for the final bill. They got their shitty amendments in, which made the bill worse, but then they voted against the final legislation. And this is how they're talking, the Republicans talk about, well, they got it through on party lines. Here you go. Before the final Senate vote in December 2009, Republicans warned they hadn't seen final details before voting on the bill. But by that point, nearly a year had passed and the big questions were all settled. Later, as the debate dragged into early 2010, Obama personally engaged Republicans at length on two separate occasions, one at a Republican Party retreat in Baltimore and then at a day-long bipartisan session at the Blair House. Totally different situation, right? Writing legislation, writes Jonathan Cohn, is almost never elegant, and there were plenty of negotiation that went on behind closed doors. The result was some famously ugly agreements, such as the Cornhusker kickback that would have boosted federal Medicaid payments to Nebraska to secure the vote of then-Senator Ben Nelson, a so-called Democrat out of Nebraska. The pharmaceutical industry cut a deal shielding it, at least temporarily, from direct federal regulation of drug prices. And he goes on. He says, but, you know, by and large, the architects of the law were clear about what they were trying to do and how they proposed to do it, in part because they'd been promoting and defending these ideas in detail ever since Obama started his presidential campaign years before. And once in power, they used the traditional committee process, if not so much to write the legislative language, then at least to give the media, interest groups, and ultimately the public an opportunity to understand what was up for discussion and eventually form an opinion on that. And he concludes the article by saying it's not hard to figure out why Senate GOP leaders are proceeding in the way they are. Although those leaders haven't indicated how they intend to resolve some key issues, the ultimate impact of the bill is already clear. As Huffington Post Jeff Young has written, that proposal would take away insurance from millions, remove consumer protections that people value, and push insurance in the direction of greater exposure to out-of-pocket costs. None of this is popular. None of this is what Republicans promised to do. Debating their bill openly would force them to admit that, and so they're trying to avoid public scrutiny for as long as possible. That's what they're doing. They're gaslighting you. Do not let them get away with it. If there's one thing to push back on, it's that Democrats did the same thing. No, they did not. And there's so much at stake. While perusing, reading about healthcare, because this is top of mind for me. This is what I am focused on right now. More than Russia, more than Georgia 6th. I read an article in The Atlantic by a friendly acquaintance of mine, and it's about, the title of the article is, Even the Insured Often Can't Afford Their Medical Bills. Helene Olin wrote that at The Atlantic, and she has another piece at The Nation, a similar one as to why big corporations are not supporting Medicare for All when they should be. We'll talk to Helene Olin next, so don't go away. I'll have the link on the blog at NicoleSandler.com when I post the podcast after the show. Okay? Okay.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Heavy rain and flash floods may have kept voters from the polls Tuesday in the special election in Georgia's 6th Congressional District. Whatever the reasons, Republican Karen Handel bested Democrat John Ossoff by almost 11,000 votes and 4 percentage points to keep a seat that's been in GOP hands since 1979. The most expensive House race in history did tighten the margins, where now HHS Secretary Tom Price won last year by 23 points. In another special election, this one to fill the seat vacated by Trump's budget director Mick Mulvaney in South Carolina, one that the Democrats virtually ignored, the margin was even closer, with Republican Ralph Norman beating Democrat Archie Parnell by only 2,800 votes, just over 3 points. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that we'll see the draft legislation of Senate Republicans' bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act as soon as this Thursday, adding that the CBO will score it Monday or Tuesday, and a vote could happen by next Thursday. But it seems that virtually no one has yet seen it. Utah Senator Mike Lee is in the working group ostensibly writing the bill, but in a video he posted online says,
I haven't seen it yet either. Even though I've been a member of this working group among Senate Republicans assigned to help narrow some of the focus of this, I haven't seen the bill. And it has become increasingly apparent in the last few days that even though we thought we were going to be in charge of writing a bill, it's not being written by us. It's apparently being written by a small handful of staffers for members of the Republican leadership in the Senate.
Arizona Republican John McCain, asked whether he's seen the bill, said, no, nor have I met any American that has. I'm sure the Russians have been able to hack in and gotten most of it. Senate Democrats Chris Murphy, Cory Booker, and Brian Schatz went in search of the text.
We're going to go down to CBO and see whether they can tell us what's in the bill.
Three of them making a show of going to the Congressional Budget Office trying to track down the details.
Newsflash. We didn't get the bill. But we didn't get the bill because CBO has an understandable confidentiality agreement with the people that they're working with.
And do they have the whole bill?
They would not confirm that they are working on the bill.
Despite a gaslighting campaign from Republicans like John McCain, who claim,
he used to complain like hell when the Democrats ran the Affordable Care Act. Now they're doing the same thing.
That's simply not the case. As the New York Times calculated, before Congress adopted the Affordable Care Act, Democrats held numerous public hearings, and the Senate debated the measure on the floor for 25 days. Senate Republican leaders plan to push through their repeal bill under arcane budget rules that would limit debate on it to 20 hours. So there will be fewer hours of public debate on the GOP bill than there were days of debate on the Affordable Care Act. Their plan is to debate the bill for just 10 hours, with no amendments allowed. Sean Spicer returned to the White House briefing room podium on Tuesday after a week passed with no on-camera press briefing, amidst criticism from Monday's session at which not even an audio recording was permitted.
We have a tremendous respect for the First Amendment, your ability to do your job.
and report and seek out ideas. And then we're going to work with you. I think the briefing is one aspect of what we do.
Spicer was asked if the president had seen the elusive Senate health care bill.
I don't know that. I know that there was some chatter today. I know the president has been on the phone extensively with the leader and with key senators. So I don't know if he's seen the legislation or not. But I know that they've been working extremely hard. And the president has been giving his input and his ideas, feedback to them. And he's very excited about where this thing is headed.
But did add,
the president clearly wants a bill that has heart in it.
He again stonewalled on a question that he'd been asked before.
A yes or no answer. Does President Trump believe that the Russian government interfered in the 2016 elections?
I think I have not sat down and talked to him about that specific thing. Obviously, we've been dealing with a lot of other issues today. I'd be glad to touch base.
Generally speaking, I mean, this conversation about Russian interference in our elections, there's 16 intelligence agencies that say that they did. The former FBI director said that without a doubt the Russians interfered.
I understand. I've seen the reports.
Does the president share those views?
I've not sat down and asked him about a specific reaction to him, so I'd be glad to touch base and get back to you.
On Tuesday night, Anderson Cooper called him out.
In some ways, the whole exercise of even asking Sean Spicer about this is sort of absurd. The president has all but spelled out his contempt for the notion that Russia meddled in the election, and he's even belittled the intelligence community for saying so. His statements and tweets suggest he thinks the answer is no, but Mr. Spicer won't answer the question. That one, or any of these? Are there tapes of the president's conversations with James Comey? Do people contribute to global warming? Did President Obama wiretap President-elect Trump? Did voter fraud give Hillary Clinton the popular vote victory? Pretty simple questions. All of them a simple yes or no, but we're not getting that. And in fact, in many cases, Mr. Spicer says he hasn't even asked the president about it. At this point, we're asking him as much as a test of the administration's transparency as anything else. The things like one sitting president wiretapping the incoming one would be kind of a big deal. Kinda. So we keep on asking week after week, month after month, and Sean Spicer keeps on saying this.
I have not asked the president since the last time we spoke about this, and I haven't spoken to him on it about the reason. I don't know. I honestly haven't asked him that specific question. I said I have not had a discussion with him on the question. I haven't talked to the president specifically about this. Yeah, I have not had an opportunity to have that discussion. I have not asked him. I have not asked the president. I haven't asked him. I can get back to you. I got to
do. And that's a bit of what's news for today. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider a contribution. We are 100% listener funded and we can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back. Nicole Sandler here, and we're back on Progressive Voices as well. So welcome back to our Progressive Voices family. All right, so I was mentioning I'm reading all about the healthcare stuff and everything I can find because this is top of mind for me, as it should be for everyone. I think it's the most important issue facing us today. Well, and I came across an article in The Atlantic written by a friendly acquaintance of mine. It's called Even the Insured Often Can't Afford Their Medical Bills, written by Helene Olin. She's the author of Pound Foolish, co-author of The Index Card. She contributes to a bunch of publications, including The Nation, where she has a monthly column, and The Atlantic, where I saw this article in the current issue. And Helene, you there?
I am here, and thank you for having me on.
Oh, thank you for being here. You know, I read this article with such great interest because I think when we find ourselves in, you know, in a piece like yours, we pay even closer attention. And this is the story that actually, I hate to say it, but that the Affordable Care Act was supposed to fix, wasn't it?
Well, that was the promise, right, that it was going to make health care more affordable to us. And in fact, what the Affordable Care Act did, and I don't want to minimize it, is it did result in people being able to get health care insurance, right? This is an important thing. Insurance, however, does not pay all your costs. And what has gone on since the imposition of the Affordable Care Act, and in the period before it, I should say, is that the cost of medical care has gone up substantially. And one of the reasons it has gone up for consumers is not just that the cost itself is going up, but that one way it has been enacted, or insurance policies have continued to be enacted, is, and this is separate from the Affordable Care Act, is that employer-based insurance is increasingly becoming a sort of risk shift operation, where the way employers are dealing with the increase in costs is they are raising deductibles, narrowing networks, and so on, with the result that people are picking up, if they're with employers, more than 50% more out-of-pocket than they did in 2010. And if they are among the top spenders, they are out several thousand dollars a year. And that was what the article was about, our top spenders.
Right. Okay. And, you know, we mentioned you also have a monthly column at The Nation. You wrote a piece last month, May 22nd issue, Why Won't More American Corporations Support Single-Payer Healthcare? And I always thought it was a no-brainer. I thought this was the place where, you know, liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans and libertarians could all come together. They don't want why should the employer have to pay for their employees' health insurance? It's just there's something very wrong about that. If we all paid a little more in taxes, we'd all be covered, and it comes out of off the employer's bottom line.
I mean, it's actually a really fascinating issue, and I'm glad you brought that column up. The essential point is that health insurance costs employers an awful lot of money. And the beginning of the piece was that Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger had talked about their support for single payer at the most recent Berkshire Hathaway meeting, which is, you know, their company, right? They have this annual meeting. And it's kind of revered by people who follow investments. And as people who know this world know, is, you know, Munger and Buffett say, you know, pretty much anything, and it's repeated like a mantra, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was like a one-day story, and it vanished. And I was like, why is that, right? Warren Buffett says he supports single payer. Charlie Munger calls our system, quote, cockamamie, and, you know, basically says we need single payer. Buffett says that, you know, that businesses are wrong, that they're asking for tax decreases, when they should be asking for the government to take this healthcare thing over.
Right.
And it's absurd. And what I really came to the conclusion is it's just this mix of this is how it's always been for most of us, a toxic ideological stew where, you know, in this country where anything is almost seen as tantamount to the first step to we're going to become the Soviet Union in 1956, and, you know, just simply fear of controversy, that nobody wants to touch this. And it was a really fascinating article to write. There is no question small businesses and most businesses would benefit from this. GM estimated a decade ago that it was the cost of providing insurance was adding $1,500 to each car it sold. Starbucks has claimed for years that the cost of benefits are more than the cost of coffee beans for them. I mean, this is a huge expense, and it's a real drag on our economy, most likely.
Right. And if they could take that expense off, there's their tax break. I mean, they are paying a tax, just it's not called a tax. It's called buying health care for, you know, paying for health care for your employees. Now, Helene Olin, there's a piece that in the last paragraph of the Nation column, you do talk about Aetna. Aetna Insurance, did I read this right? Is Aetna talking about the feasibility of what we're calling single payer, which really is Medicare for all?
Right. I mean, understand from the insurance perspective, a number of insurers have more or less said that they would support opening discussions of this, right? They don't quite come out and say we support single payer. But what we know is that the insurance companies are actually quite prominent in Medicare, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that what it appears is that they simply see an expansion of Medicare as an expansion of their business, because I guarantee you, if we did some form of Medicare expansion, they would be in the thick of it.
Yep.
So they have no reason to oppose it. This like led to my running Twitter joke that John Ossoff was actually to the right of Aetna when it came to single payer.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's something that we didn't talk about at the beginning of the show. I opened up, it's the summertime blues now. But John Ossoff, you know, people poo-pooed Bernie Sanders for questioning whether or not John Ossoff was truly progressive. Well, he didn't endorse Medicare for All. To me, that's not progressive.
Right. I mean, you know, I think you could say a lot about that district. And I mean, I tend to be one of the people who thinks it was probably an unwinnable district mm-hmm. in any case.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, as I also always joke, if you give people a choice between a real Republican and a Democratic centrist, they'll go with the real thing every
sure.
time. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer. And the Democratic Party is going to need to grapple with this at some point.
Without a doubt. So Warren Buffett says he's for Medicare for All. You know, there's a lot of talk. Democrats often use they're not good with the bumper sticker, you know, sayings. They're not good with the vernacular. Medicare for All is a lot more understandable to most people than single payer. It's single payer because it's one entity pays the bills. In this case, it's the government paying out of our tax dollars if we were to all pay into it. That's how every other civilized, industrialized nation does it, pretty much, isn't it?
Pretty much. I mean, you know, you could buy insurance supplements, or there's, in some countries, you know, there's regulated insurance markets, which we don't really have here either, by the way, right?
Right.
And you know, pharmaceuticals are set, the pricing is set by the government, unlike here as well. So it's, we are a real outlier at this point, and I don't think people truly realize how much of an outlier we are. I think people simply take the system for granted. And this system, I should say, doesn't really work for most people. And that was kind of the point of the Atlantic article, to bring this conversation back for a minute,
okay.
was that people are getting slammed if they get ill with thousands of dollars in expenses. They often can't pay it. They are scrambling to get money in any way, shape, or form they can. And the money, frankly, really isn't there. There's no great pot of charity money that is going to help people with these out-of-control medical bills. One of the things I found when I worked on the article is you know, there's a lot of talk, you know, now about crowdfunding, right?
Right.
Put your disease on, you GoFundMe, right?
Yep, yep.
And it turns out 90% of those campaigns are not fully funded.
Right.
And not only aren't they fully funded, the vast majority of them seem to be coming out of the states that didn't take the Medicaid expansion.
Ooh.
These are desperate people. But
right.
they're in their own social world.
Again, you know, I do this show through my own lens. It's my own life experience. It's what I know. And therefore, I can talk about it with a bit of authority because I've lived it. And so my listeners know I went through a fight with lung cancer last year. You know it as well, Helene,
right.
Because, you know, when I got hit with the diagnosis, I had insurance through the exchange. I live in Florida, and I'm self-employed. This is what I do for a living. I don't have anybody paying me a salary. It's all listener donations for what I do. So my whole life is crowdfunded, basically. And, you know, although I got had a decent policy, there are still copays, deductibles, and there's that out-of-pocket maximum. And it could be, depending on the policy you get, and it's very confusing if you don't know what you're doing. A lot of people just went, well, I'll buy a bronze plan because it's the cheapest. It may be cheapest in premiums, but you know, it's all the other stuff that kills you. And so people get sick and they realize what was affordable on a monthly basis is in the long run going to cost you a fortune, and you may not be able to afford to get sick. So many people do. Right. And I'll be honest, the contributions that friends and listeners and some people I don't know, you know, gave to my, I used a group called You Caring because frankly, their fees were lower than GoFundMe. You know, that got me through almost a year. And if not for that, I really don't know how I would have made it. And so, and I'm someone, you know, who understands to the best that I can how to navigate this. I really took my time and I bought a good policy, and it still doesn't cover everything. So, and as we said at the beginning, the Affordable Care Act was supposed to keep us from medical bankruptcy, but a lot of people find that they have an insurance policy, but maybe they didn't do their homework well enough, or they couldn't afford the monthly premium of the silver plan, and so they got a cheaper one, and now they can't afford the copays and the deductibles.
Right. Well, I mean, most people people aren't going to get sick in any given year. So in one sense, you know, going with the, you know, highest deductible, lowest fee, narrowest network actually makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is nobody knows when they're going to get sick. This isn't like an exactly a predictable thing for people, right? And second, you know, many people don't even have much of a choice about what insurance plans they're going to get. Often at work, there's very limited choice. On the exchanges, there's not a huge amount of choice either.
And more so now.
And the right. And there's not a lot of control going on here, or I should say there's not a lot of control by the individual going on here. It is, in many cases, rather hard to stay within network. Something that got cut out of the final draft of the story is that roughly somewhere between about around 1 in 4 consumers over a 2 to 3 year period will get whacked with what's called a surprise medical bill. That's when you go to, say, the emergency room and you think you're in network because your hospital is in network, and boom, it turns out that all the doctors in the emergency room were not in network. And there's very little recourse for consumers, or patients, I should say. When that happens, a couple of states have laws regulating the practice. Unfortunately, that can only regulate state-based plans, not employer-funded plans under ERISA, the federal laws. There is no federal law to prevent this.
Wow.
Most states still don't have any protection
Wow.
at all. And people are just sitting there stuck with bills, and
Yep.
there's not a lot they can do.
Yeah, I found that out the hard way, by the way. One of the doctors at the emergency room where I went to when I was first diagnosed was not in the network. And I called the hospital just freaking out. It's like, I don't understand. You did all my paperwork. You went through all this whole process to make sure that everything was covered by insurance, and you have a doctor who doesn't take my insurance? How can that be? But they do that regularly. So now I tell everyone, if you're going to go to the emergency room, every doctor you see, you have to ask, because otherwise
right.
you're going to get stuck with a bill of potentially many thousands of dollars.
Right. And many people in the emergency room, by the way, are in no position to ask.
That's right.
It's the middle of the night.
Yep.
Or they're having a real emergency.
That's
right.
Right.
If you're there, say, because you think you're having a heart attack, probably best not to wait the extra half hour for an in-network doctor.
That's right.
Right. I mean, the whole situation is just functionally absurd. But what's going on is, and this was in the Atlantic article, was that people are just getting whacked with bills after bills after bills, and that they are frantically trying to find money to pay them, and it's simply really not there. You know, roughly, you know, 43% of us claim we can't come up with $400 or $500 if we needed to in an emergency without turning to credit. There is no give there for many people. So the minute somebody breaks a leg, you know, their finances just sort of go into free fall.
Right. So I understand those who are in this situation now, but the situation was there before the Affordable Care Act. For many of us, it was worse because of the pre-existing condition. You couldn't get insurance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of the lucky ones because I was in that boat. I couldn't get insurance. So the Affordable Care Act comes in. I got insurance. I paid more than because I'm nervous and I saw the future or something, but I got a good policy. And now here I am the second year, you know, the year after being diagnosed, when I went to renew it, of course, the HMO that I was on no longer does my oncology group take that HMO. So I had to go to the higher, more expensive PPO for this year in order to be able to still see my doctors. And now I'm at the point where I don't know what's going to happen in 2018. So the Republicans, Helene Olin is with us, by the way, if the Republicans get their wish, now they're pushing tomorrow, allegedly, we're going to see at least a draft summary of their new Trump Care bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Donald Trump says he wants it to be not so mean as the House bill was. But do you see any indication that it won't be?
Absolutely not. And, you know, and I think this goes to sort of the general rage that's out there, for lack of a better word, in our culture right now, right, is we're in this position, to digress for a second, where mm-hmm. people are being are defending the Affordable Care Act, as well they should be, by the way, because the Republican plan is infinitely worse. But in fact, the insurance system in many ways is not is not exactly ideal for many people. So on one hand, we're kind of defending a system that really isn't working terribly well for a lot of people. On the other hand, if you don't defend it, you leave people in a much worse position. The estimates are that an additional 23 million people will lose insurance over the next decade should the Republican bill come to pass. Now, that's obviously a bad situation, but people are not getting help in a lot of ways for what they need now. And what they need now is lower deductibles, more guaranteed payments, probably really some form of Medicare expansion, and it's simply not even on the table, and that's a huge problem, and I think it's one of the things that's leading to so much cynicism and anger out there. Nobody is listening to most people.
No, and I always ask, to what end? You know, they want it. They're saying we want to make it better. We want to bring down premiums and costs and make it more patient centric, which is all total, complete, and utter bullshit. It's the only word I can use to describe what they're doing. What they want to do is give the wealthiest among us another tax break at the expense of those of us who need health care. Andy Slavitt is the former administrator or former acting administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He was on CNN this morning. He said he was at the Senate yesterday and was trying to feel around to find out what's in this bill. I want to play a little clip of what he said this bill encompasses.
I spent a better part of the day with the Senate yesterday, and near as I could tell, the best way I could describe it is we're going to get something like a Frankenstein monster of health care. This is going to be something that very few can love. It's going to end Medicaid as we know it. The question is only how quickly. And in order to get a better score out of the CBO, they're going to try to make the tax credits look more like Obamacare tax credits, only without any money to do it. So it'll be a sort of a cheap version of Obamacare. So I think Senator Paul had it close to right yesterday when he said every Democrat in the country is going to hate it, and more than half the Republicans are going to hate it, because it's really just a monstrosity that the leader's putting together to try to figure out how to get enough people to like it. Very hard.
It's that vicious circle, but to what end? So what, they kick 23, 25, 28 million people off of the insurance rolls? Then what happens?
I know. I mean, and I think one of the things that's still going on with this bill is I think people do not realize how much it's going to hurt people with employer health insurance or their families, right? One of the largest users of Medicaid, to give a perfect example, is not the, you know, the traditional welfare queen that probably people imagine when they think of Medicaid. It's the elderly person in a mm-hmm. nursing home who's mm-hmm. out of assets, right? Like
right.
your parent or my parent, right?
Right.
And people don't realize that that's going to be a huge hit. Similarly, they don't realize that at least as of now, it appears that one of the things in that bill is that they are going to restore limits on how much an insurer needs to pay out. Right now, as you probably remember in the pre-ACA days, an employer plan could cap out at $1 million or
right.
so, which left a lot of people in a very bad position, actually. $1 million is
Doesn't
not a lot of
far.
Money when somebody
nope.
gets quite ill. Especially now with cancer drugs that cost over $100,000 a year. And this appears to be back in the bill. So a lot of people are about to get a nasty surprise should this come to pass.
And as we were talking about in the first segment of the show, this is Mitch McConnell's game plan, is to delay and delay so that there's very little time for people to get to know what's in the bill. If we're lucky, I don't think the entire text will be released tomorrow. It'll probably be like a one sheet, a fact sheet. I don't know when they're planning on releasing the whole thing. Maybe when the CBO score comes out on Monday or Tuesday. And then they're talking about voting as soon as Thursday. They want to jam this vote through before people have a chance to find out what's in it.
For a reason.
Yes. Right. And they want to do it before the 4th of July recess, because the 4th of July recess, congressmen go home and get an earful from their constituents. Well, this is what we need to do, whether they're home or in D.C. There's a group of 10. I don't know if you saw this, the Resist Trump Care 10. that of senators who are in places where perhaps more moderate Republicans or that are more more likely to say no. People like Lisa Murkowski and Sullivan from Alaska, Jeff Flake from Arizona, Cory Gardner from Colorado, Susan Collins from Maine, Dean Heller from Nevada, who's up for re-election, by the way, in 2018, Rob Portman from Ohio, Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, what is her name? Moore Capito from West Virginia and Cassidy from Louisiana. I know that from what I understand, when Mike Lee did his little bitching Facebook Live video saying, I'm in the working group and I don't even know what's in it. I haven't seen it. Cassidy is one that McConnell is supposedly, you know, ushering along because he knows he needs his vote. But all we need is three of them to say, you know what? Too fast, not good enough. This is no good. And so people, especially in those states, need to call those senators.
Right. But I mean, relying on Republican moderates to do the right thing is a long known way of not having things happen for us. Right.
Absolutely.
You know, their moderate cred their reputation is better than it actually is, shall we say. But on the other hand, should people be calling? Absolutely. It's probably
the only real
chance to stop this.
That's it.
Whether it will or not, count me as a skeptical one. I mean, I'm very concerned about this at this point.
I am too.
And I think the only way to stop it is to have the mass calling.
And that's what we got to do. And that's why, there's that, we talked about it yesterday, the Resist Bot app that you could will fax letters for you. I say, you know, call every single day. Look, I call Marco Rubio's office and I play the nice person saying, I know he's got a bigger heart than this. I know he doesn't want me to die. They tabulate the phone calls they get. So it's, I mean, do you see Helene Olin? Do you see any other avenue to take to stop this from going through?
Well, I mean, long term, what I would see is that the Democratic Party really needs to talk about health care as a right, and that it is not a profit center for the insurance companies and the hospitals. Whether they're willing to do that, because that takes on so many vested interests, I can't tell you. I mean, but the Medicare for All language, which you spoke mm-hmm. about earlier in the program, is the exact way forward here. I mean, we know the private system is not working for a lot of people. There's no way to sort of make this happen at this point. The Republicans want what the Republicans want, and it's really coming to the point where you're either going to go on the offensive or we're going to lose everything. I mean, that's kind of how I see it at this point, that this sort of defensive rear guard game that the Democrats have been playing now for basically a generation has basically led us to the point where we are today, right?
Mm-hmm.
And any other way forward is simply not working for us. This playing nice and making things, we'll give you this, just didn't help, right?
Right.
We can't go back in time and get the public option or a Medicare buy-in in 2009 anymore. The next step is simply to call these people constantly, go to these town meetings, continue to protest, and make it clear that there will be consequences to this, that you are going to blame them at the polls when bad things happen. And they will if this passes. I mean, there's no way you could have this many uninsured people and have a fair and equitable society.
Right. So when you call, I mean, even just talk about why rush into this. If you're going to do it, why not do it right and make sure we all know what's in this bill? You've got plenty of time. There's no reason to rush into it. I mean, anything, if we can even delay it past July 4th, they'll get an earful. Then we get to know exactly what's in it and we can push on the specific issues. All we do know is that it's not going to be good.
Right, and that's the last point. I know we're probably running low on time soon. Is, you know, the Democratic Party also needs to step up to the plate here.
Oh.
And they can slow the Senate down to a huge degree and potentially stop this before July 4th. But they need to do that. I can't do that in my apartment. You can't do that in your studio. They can do that. And that's why, by the way, it's also important, even if you live in a state that it does not have a Republican senator, to call your Democratic senator and tell them you want this stopped by every means possible.
Right. And we were talking with Gotta Laugh yesterday, who's in California. If you've got two Democratic senators, great. Tell them, you know, urge them to keep doing the slowdown. The all night session they had the other night was okay. They just need to do whatever they can, whatever means at their disposal to slow this thing down, because that's the best tool we have right now. The more informed the electorate, the better our chances are. And that's why Mitch McConnell is pushing this through so quickly.
Right. He wants to get it done before people realize how awful it is.
Oh, I'm not confident. That's what scares me. One last question, Helene Olin. After what happened in Georgia, well, you said you didn't think that was a winnable district anyway. Do you have any faith at all in the Democrats going forward that they're going to get their shit together enough to pull something out in 2018?
I think the rush of the past few months in these districts we lost elections in has been, people have wanted to short-circuit a process, right? Mm-hmm. There is obviously going to be a lot of recriminations in the Democratic Party post the Hillary Clinton loss, right? This is a kind of no-brainer for people. And I think people were kind of hoping that we would get a couple of quick victories here, Montana, Kansas, fill in the blank of what state, right? Mm-hmm. And we would move forward again. But in fact, these are things that need to be discussed and hashed out. Where are we going forward? And I think the one issue with the resistance so far that is one that isn't discussed as much as it probably needs to be is it is anti-Trump, but it's not clear exactly what it is for at this point.
Right, exactly.
Is it for somebody moderate like Ossoff, or is it for somebody who supports Medicare for all like Sanders?
Right.
It probably in the end cannot be both.
Right. It's what are you fighting for? Helene Olin, find her. I will put links to both of the pieces we talked about, the one in The Nation and the new one at The Atlantic, up on my blog at NicoleSandler.com, along with the podcast of today's show. Thank you so much for coming on with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. You take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Helene Olin. And tomorrow, Digby's with us. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.
summer dreams still spinning round my mind. And then, where they begin. And I want to grab that river and stop the love that's dying. Because I know that somewhere deep inside my soul you're still lying. Waiting to awaken and shake that river's blood. Love, love, where did you go? They told me that the sun turned green. I said I didn't know. And they told me that the moon turned blue. I said I didn't show. And they told me that I looked a fool. And I said I'd let that go. But when they told me that our love was dead, I had to turn and go. All of